You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told lawmakers last week that the White House will sell $8 billion in weapons to countries including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. We'll talk about the deal, the White House's decision to sidestep Congress, and how it could impact U.S.-Middle East relations. First, President Trump announced last week that he'll be rolling out a second round of aid payments for farmers. The move comes as the trade war with China continues and as farmers and other industries feel the squeeze from retaliatory tariffs. Here's the president hinting at the aid package 2 weeks ago at the White House.
China will be retaliating probably to a certain extent against our farmers. We're going to take the highest year, the biggest purchase that China has ever made with our farmers, which is about $15 billion, and do something reciprocal to our farmers so our farmers can do well. They'll be planting, they'll be able to sell for less, and they'll make the same kind of money until such time as it's all straightened out.
Steve Deller is a professor with UW-Madison's Agricultural and Applied Economics Program. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, as you're seeing it, I think some of the details are still to be worked out, but what's in this new second round of aid for farmers?
It's basically the same type of a program. Again, a lot of the details have not been worked out. There are some differences between the last one and this one. For example, the last one, it was based on production. How many bushels did you produce? How much milk did you produce? This time it's going to be based on acreage, things like that. So there's lots of little details in there that are a little bit different, but it's basically the same type of policy.
And one of the concerns was that if it's based on, say, current year's acreage or production, it might be encouraging farmers to plant crops that would fit into the subsidy program, kind of a weird incentive.
That was last year. This year, they're actually trying to change that. And they're basically saying that it will be based on the actual planting ratios that are in place at the time. The problem, though, and this is one of the details that has not been worked out, is that it is only going to count land that is in production right now. Now, the problem that we've got is that we've had a very wet spring. And there is a number of counties where the farmers have just simply not been able to get into the fields. Wisconsin, for example, the numbers just came out about an hour ago. So this is the most current numbers. Right now for corn planting, for example, about 82% of all the corn that's going to be planted has been planted historically. We're at 46% right now. Other states like Illinois and Indiana, they're at terribly low numbers. Now, the problem that that creates is that if you don't have your crops in the field by the time these policies are decided, you may be left out.
Now, even if all goes well, is this enough of a difference maker for farmers who are hurt by the impacts of trade?
No. I was talking to a farmer this afternoon, and what she was describing was essentially the farm economy is hemorrhaging money, and we need it. We need a tourniquet, and this is a Band-Aid. For example, last year, corn was basically a penny on a bushel, which is basically a rounding error. For milk, it was 12 cents a hundredweight. And when milk prices are around $16 a hundredweight, 12 cents is nothing. It will be a short-term aid to some farmers. But it's a Band-Aid on a hemorrhaging wound.
Let's talk about a double whammy here. For some commodities, I guess I'm thinking milk in particular, prices were already low, period. And there's this trade war that's hitting them again.
One of the things that makes this particular period in farming different than historically is that I was just looking at some farm data going back to 1969. And historically, you'll see kind of this up and down pattern, 1 year down, the next year up, maybe 2 years down, 2 years up. But there's this kind of cyclical pattern that farmers are very used to. So they're kind of used to being able to ride these things out. This is the first time since the farm crisis of the early 1980s that we're going into year five of down prices. It's that long-term downward trend that many farmers are simply they're not able to cash flow it anymore.
1 year, I could say, is a bad year. Maybe I can make it through to next year. Five years,
I can't do that. And that's where so many farmers are hurling. So this payment that's coming from the trade component of the support programs that are out there, it's not enough to reverse that.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison's Agricultural and Applied Economics Program about the Trump administration plan to pay $16 billion out to farmers impacted by a trade war, mainly with China. Steve, as a policy, farming or otherwise, do we see this kind of, I guess, trade adjustment payment made? Is this something we've done before?
Only in dire emergencies. I mean, you would have to go back to the farm crisis of the early 80s to see something like this. Part of what makes this a little bit different is that this it's almost like icing on the cake of a bad situation. Is what the trade policy is doing. So if you're implementing policies that are impacting the farmers in a negative way, there's kind of this political need to kind of compensate them for those poor policy decisions. Now, we could get into a discussion about whether or not the current conditions between China and the U.S. are appropriate or not, but the farmers are getting caught up in that fight.
Right. The goal, as the Trump administration states it, is, okay, yes, times are going to be tough in the short run, but we're going to come out with a better deal once we get through this and negotiate a more fair deal. They say everybody, farmers and everybody, is going to be better off.
A fair deal for who? What essentially has started this is the logical argument that China doesn't really respect international patent and copyright laws. China is known for essentially stealing intellectual property rights and patents and copyrights and things like that. And they've been doing it for years and years and years. And that's really what has started a lot of this. If we're going to stop them from doing this, we've got to get tough on them. And that's what got us into this. Now, we can argue whether that's a good idea or not a good idea, but what's happened is that farmers have got caught up in that political fight.
Now, I've talked to some people who were supporters of trade deals, NAFTA, World Trade Organization deals, other international trade negotiations, who said those were good things, but we should have done a part two. We should have had some kind of support program for people whose jobs were disrupted. The factories that shut down after NAFTA, people like that. Philosophically, do you see a role for the government in helping people adjust to the impacts of international trade, whether that's more free trade or tariff wars like we have now?
I think you're right. I mean, there is a transition. When you have a major policy change, there will be transition. There will be winners and losers. With the idea behind free trade is that 99 out of 100 economists will argue that in the long term, free trade, there are more winners than there are losers. But what do you do with those losers in the short term? And this is where I think that there could be policies put into place to kind of help transition that. Most of the time, it's worker related, so it's providing training opportunities, retraining opportunities, programs like that that we've been trying to do. There's question about whether that will work or not. So you could make an argument that you know, we're having this fundamental discussion with China, and farmers are getting caught up in the middle of it. Should we help farmers in that transition period? You could make a logical argument for that. The problem, though, is that the timing of it is such that this really isn't going to help most farmers.
We're talking to Steve Deller from the Agricultural and Applied Economics Program at UW-Madison about $16 billion in aid President Trump says is coming to farmers who have been hurt by the trade war with China. We'll go to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks so much. China seems to have benefited quite a bit from unfair trade practices, including the intellectual property theft of the United States, and have leapfrogged tons of countries to become the second most powerful economy in the world. If they are going to continue to have the unfair practices and actually illegal practices that they've been using for the last couple of decades, don't at some point we have to stop and not allow this anymore? And yes, it's going to hurt in the short run, but don't we have to stop sometime? Thanks so much.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Steve, your thoughts?
I think you're right. there is unfair trade on that regard, and it's been the pattern for a number of years. The problem, though, is I don't think the U.S. can convince China to change its practices on its own. This would have to take a number of trading partners of China's trading partners to come together and essentially as a unified front come to China and say either you change your ways or you know, we're going to start taking this much more seriously. So I think you're right, but I think that the way that the president is addressing it is probably not the most strategic way.
Wasn't that one of the hopes for the Trans-Pacific Partnership that ended up being a target for President Trump and for Senator Bernie Sanders on the campaign trail? The idea that, okay, we get together all these countries and not China, and we have more leverage over them?
That's exactly right. Essentially, that trade policy, the TPP, essentially established the trading rules amongst many of the growing Southeast Asian countries or the East Asian countries. And when we decided that we weren't going to participate in that anymore, we essentially kind of set ourselves up for failure. It's better to have a seat at the table and try to influence those discussions than to simply get up and walk away.
Charlie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Mike in Shorewood. Mike, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I heard a few weeks ago a representative from the African American Farmers Association, and he was talking about the first group of subsidies last year that they hadn't seen one penny of that money. And I guess my question to your commentator is, when does the money get dispersed? Why is this thought of as a better solution when I'm assuming it's just more bureaucracy, more red tape for farmers, something they don't want to deal with? And if the first round of subsidies hasn't been delivered, you know, when can we expect this next $16 billion to be handed out to farmers?
Mike, thanks for the call. I don't know about the timeline for the first one, Steve. I know this one's supposed to be in, I think, three installments.
It's three installments, and the first one is supposed to be around July, and then the second around October, November, and then the third one in January. The first one is pretty much guaranteed. If there is an agreement, a trade agreement with China, the second and third ones won't be paid. Not all farmers are eligible for this. This is supposed to be for farmers that have been affected by the trade disputes. And last year, the ones that was kind of at the forefront of the trade dispute was soybeans. Most of the money went to soybeans. For example, dairy's been impacted a little bit by the trade fight. Dairy's going to get a fairly small subsidy. So the African American farmers, it depends on what their commodity is. What are they making? What are they growing? Are they into a commodity market that's being affected by this trade policy? If they are, then they should be eligible for these payments. If they're not, then this program is not for them.
Mike, thanks for that call. Yeah, soy has been the big story. I think people are talking some about pork. Are there any other products, especially of interest to Wisconsin, that might be in the running for this assistance?
It's primarily corn and soybeans is the big one. In Wisconsin, though, a lot of the corn and soybeans goes into animal feed. So it's the big one is dairy, but there's some very small specialty crops, like, say, ginseng or cranberries. I don't know how much cranberries is exported to China. I don't think the last data I looked at, it doesn't get that fine. I know that the ginseng that's produced, a lot of that does go to the Asian market, but I don't think it is part of the program because it's such a small piece of the overall puzzle.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Steve Deller, professor with UW-Madison's Agricultural and Applied Economics Program. Steve, more generally, how dependent is Wisconsin agriculture on exports?
It is, tremendously, but our primary trading is Mexico and Canada. We do see a growing amount of our exports going to China, but it is... it's still a smaller share than Mexico and Canada. There are two big trading partners in terms of dairy. That's why when there was the renegotiation of NAFTA, that's where Wisconsin was more affected by that. The dairy industry was more affected by that negotiation than the dispute with China.
Let's bring on another caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have just a couple comments. My first comment is, I'm not sure how the tariffs are going to work when the person imposing the tariffs doesn't even understand how the tariffs work. And my second comment is, we talk about unfair trade practices. We talk about China taking our jobs. Well, it was the tax cuts during the Bush administration that took 5 million manufacturing jobs that the money given to those corporations built brand new factories in China and in Asia and Indonesia.
Mike, thanks for the call. So on that first point, he's referring to President Trump has talked about China paying the tariffs. A lot of people point out that China doesn't pay them, importers pay them, and consumers in many cases have those costs passed along to them.
That's exactly right. The Chinese are not going to pay for the tariffs. The only way they pay for the tariffs is the price of their exports go up, so the demand for their exports go down a little bit. The person who ends up paying it is the consumer. Now, the question is whether or not the, I don't want to say wholesalers, but the input, the firms that are buying things from China in their production processes, are they able to pass those costs on to the consumers? And that's going to vary from industry to industry. But in the end, the consumer ends up paying for these tariffs.
So how do you see this if we don't end up with a deal, if these tariffs stay in place? How do you see that affecting farmers in Wisconsin and around the country in the next couple of years?
Well, what happens to a large extent is that China is going to start going to some of our competitors to buy the products that they need, particularly with soybeans, for example. It's Brazil is a major producer. And over time, our competitors are going to be able to increase their production to such an extent that they will essentially be able to, they'll be able to sidestep these tariffs. And it will leave the U.S. farmers kind of out in the cold.
Now, I've seen some people say, Steve, that part of the problem with dairy now in particular is that we have overproduction. We have too much milk in Wisconsin, in the United States, on the world market. And if that's the case, prices are never going to go up to this supporting level. What do you think of that?
That's essentially true. One of the ways is that we are producing too much milk. And the argument that we can grow the demand for milk in the U.S. is fairly limited. We can grow the demand for cheese and things like that, but the real potential is foreign exports, is where the growth potential is. We can't grow out of the surplus milk problem by expanding foreign exports. We're simply producing too much. And that's part of the reasons why we're in this kind of fifth year of stress, is because the markets have not responded adequately to kind of rectify that problem. For example, in Wisconsin right now, some of the cheese processing plants are importing milk from Michigan. Because it's just Michigan is producing way more milk than they can process, and it is they're essentially trying to, rather than pouring the milk down the drain where they lose all their money, is they're shipping it over to Wisconsin and charging a slightly less price, and that essentially has a ripple effect.
So what do you see as the best way out of this battle with China in particular over tariffs?
I think the only way that we're going to see a long-term solution to this is if the U.S. trading partners kind of come together and act as a block and go to China as a block and say that, you need to better respect our patents, our copyrights, our intellectual property rights. You need to better enforce your own laws. In China, it is technically illegal to steal somebody's patent idea. The problem is that the Chinese courts don't enforce those laws. Until we can get that fundamental problem changed, this is something that is going to continue to put China at a comparative advantage over us. But the U.S. doing this alone isn't going to work. It's going to take our trading partners working together to put pressure on China to change that.
But President Trump's trade philosophy seems to be pretty consistently bilateral. The U.S. negotiates with country X, the U.S. doesn't negotiate with a group of countries.
And that's unfortunate, because I think the only way we're going to get the leverage to convince China to play by the rules is if we approach them as a bloc. And President Trump prefers not to do that. So I think that this could be a very long, dragged out trade war, and the farmers are getting caught in the middle.
We'll leave it there. Steve, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Deller, professor in the Agricultural and Applied Economics Program at UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about $16 billion in aid President Trump says will be coming to farmers as the U.S.-China trade war continues. Coming up, we'll talk about an $8 billion arms deal with Middle Eastern countries, including Saudi Arabia, that the White House finalized without congressional approval. We'll look at the details of that, and you can join in with your thoughts. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told federal lawmakers last week that the U.S. will sell $8 billion worth of arms and weapons to countries including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Congress has not given its approval for that move, and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have objected to the sale. However, President Trump, citing a security threat from Iran, invoked an emergency authority to proceed with the deal. Our next guest joins us to talk about the president's decision to sidestep Congress and what it could mean in the Middle East. Ali Abutalabi is a professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. Ali, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, what were your initial reactions to this decision from the White House?
Well, you have to question the policy. Saudi Arabia, of course, has been engaged in a war in Yemen since 2015. And we know Yemen is a horrific situation where half of the population is on the verge of starvation. And there is no justification to continue selling arms to Saudi Arabia. Congress is against it. Some of our European allies are against it, and they are not selling arms to Saudis. So the question is, why are we doing this? And Saudi Arabia really is fourth or fifth in the world in terms of the amount of money they spend on defense. And they engage in a war in Yemen, which is one of the poorest Arab states, with horrific consequences. So we have to question that policy.
The argument has been from the White House and from the Secretary of State that this help is needed for Saudi Arabia to help balance the threat from Iran in Yemen and elsewhere in the region. What do you say to that?
Well, Iran spent about $15 billion a year on its defense. While Saudi Arabia, again, is more than 80, perhaps, billion dollars, if not more. Iran is being accused of using some of these proxies, whether it's in Iraq or Yemen, as to kind of agitate Saudi Arabia. There may be certain truth to that, but claiming that Iran has threatened U.S. position and interest in the region without providing any substantive truth is rather dubious proposition. Remember, we still have the fresh memory from Iraq war, how basically the information was manipulated to justify invasion of Iraq in 2003. So we have to question if there are imminent threat against U.S. Interests in the region, we need to see some evidence. And, of course, the administration cannot provide for that. There were some rumors about there was actually one Katyusha fired in Iraq by one of the militias in Iraq toward the American embassy, so to speak, with zero casualties. And there could be an act done by some of the militias in Iraq, regardless of what Iran wants or not. It is possible, should there be a conflict, unfortunately, between the United States and Iran, Iran would use some of these proxies to counter U.S. attack. That might be a scenario. But to argue that we need to send additional troops and we need to send more arms to Saudi Arabia in order to counter Iran, it's a far cry from the truth.
Ali Abutalibi is with us, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. We're talking about an agreement from the White House to provide arms to Saudi Arabia and other countries in the Middle East without the approval of Congress. Now, Ali, what role does Congress usually play in these kind of deals?
Well, you know, we sell a lot of arms on an annual basis. For example, last year, more than $192 billion worth of arms were sold by the United States. But they're fundamentally categorized at foreign military sales, which is done by the United States government and its supervision, so to speak. And that came to about $55 billion a year last year. But the lion's share of that, almost about $137 billion, was sold as direct commercial sales. Direct commercial sales allow American companies to directly negotiate with other countries to sell their arms without much of a supervision. So arms is a big industry, as I said, $192 billion last year. And the year before that was $170 billion. It's a big money earner and also it creates some jobs at home. But selling $55 billion, you know, in terms of where government actually is involved in terms of foreign military sales, that's still a substantive amount of money. So we are basically number one in the world in terms of arms transfer. Last year, we sold about 38% of total world arms transfers. And, of course, the Russians followed us by about 22%. We understand if some people argue about arms transfer in terms of money earners. But you have to question, particularly when it comes to sensitive countries like Saudi Arabia, since they are engaged in a war with Yemen, and the possibility of war with Iran perhaps is looming. We have to question the wisdom of such arms transfer. In a way, bringing more arms to the region, it could increase the probability of the usage of arms. So when it comes to direct, the kind of the foreign military sales, Congress has all the right to question that. Since they have the power of the purse and they are a branch of government, they have to question the executive branch and the wisdom of the policy.
Can you talk more about the war in Yemen and the humanitarian impact that has had?
Well, you know, Yemen, along with many other Arab states, back in 2011, had the Arab Spring movement, so to speak. And Yemenis, since 2011, have been trying to have a better life for themselves through a more representative government. And because the last dictator of Yemen was there for about 30 years or so, and he was overthrown. And again, before he was overthrown, his vice president, who's currently technically the remnant of the last regime, claimed to be the legitimate government. While at the same time, Yemen, in the northern part of Yemen, the Houthi minorities that have taken arms against this defunct government and started the fight since about 2013. And Saudi Arabia basically is seeing the Houthis, who are a minority Shia in Yemen, as a threat to his own national security. They intervened in Yemen in 2015, especially when the United States signed the nuclear agreement with Iran. They increasingly became more involved in Yemen. Yemen, as I said, is a very poor Arab country with poor limited number of targets. So Saudis, they have been basically destroying the infrastructure. And that has led to food insecurity, lack of water, the spread of diseases, and even United Nations is not able to do all it can do. And major Yemeni ports are being occupied by pro-Saudi forces. And in recent time, through an agreement, some of the rebels, so to speak, and the Houthis and remnants of the Yemen government or military, they decided to withdraw from the ports, provided that the United Nations increases food aid to the people who are in need. In short, Yemen is a mess. You're talking about, as I said, about half of the population are being food insecure, with a good number of people on the verge of starvation. The perpetuation of this war should really lead to outcry by the international community. But unfortunately, we don't see much of that. And we don't see much of that perhaps primarily because the threat from Iran is being hyped up to the security of Saudi Arabia or Israel, for that matter. And with the increased U.S. military pressure and naval presence in the Persian Gulf, we've kind of gone from a bad situation to a worse situation. We bring in more weapons whereby more aid is needed.
The Saudis and others have said that the Houthis in Yemen are, in effect, proxies of Iran. Is that fair?
I think the Iranian connection to Houthis is over-exaggerated. There is no mind that Iran has an interest to give aid to Houthis, including some arms perhaps, to give Saudis hard time, so to speak. But let's say Iran is not part of the equation tomorrow. The fact remains that Yemen has problem. Yemen was already divided as a divided country in the 1960s. It was reunited in the 1990s. And since then, again, we've had this defunct regime running the government, the countries, and the Houthi minorities, who are really about perhaps 35, maybe more percentage of the population, they were under tremendous pressure. When they took arm and they moved towards Sana'a, the capital, then everything got out of hand. What is needed in Yemen, of course, is reconciliation, establishment of a new government, independent government, and perhaps with even some Arab state money for Yemen to rebuild itself. War is not going to go anywhere. Yemenis have proven themselves to be resilient. A fundamentally tribal environment. But since 2011, since the dawn of Arab Spring, Yemen has been crying for more responsible government and better situation for Yemeni people. Regardless of Iran, and Yemen had this issue, Iran, of course, would use Yemen if they could in order to counterattack American pressure on Iran. But to argue that what's going on in Yemen is a proxy war and Iranians are putting weapons there is a fallacy. This is not true. The arms transfer from Iran is very limited. Again, whatever evidence that we have, it does not show that Iran is heavily involved in Yemen. But unfortunately, Yemen has become a scapegoat for Iranian threat when it comes to Saudi Arabia.
Ali Aboutalibi is with us, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. He's with us to talk about the recent news that the White House will finalize an $8 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and other Middle Eastern countries. The White House is citing an emergency power to sidestep Congress in order to make the sale, citing Iran as a security threat in the region. We'll go to a caller now. Joyce is with us in Wausau. Joyce, hi. Joyce, do we have you? We don't have Joyce. We'll see if we can. Oh, here she is. Joyce, hi.
Hi. Hello.
Good. What did you want to bring up, Joyce?
I have friends that live in Yemen as well as Yemenis that have gotten out of the country or are living in Great Britain. And from the viewpoint of these people who are some of the very, very best young people, at any rate, from their viewpoint and from everything that I've heard, and I try to keep up on the news over there, what the Saudis are doing is they are totally destroying the infrastructure, which means the roads, the airports, the ports themselves are, you know, being taken over by the Saudis, so that the people cannot survive. They are starving. And the medical supplies, Doctors Without Borders, things like that, they're just not able to keep up with everything that has happened because of the bombing of the country. And they may say, oh, well, they're, you know, bombing the Houthis or whatever, but in effect, what they're doing is bombing to destroy the infrastructure of the country. I truly do not believe Iran really cares that much. I mean, sure, they're going to cheer on the Houthis because of what they're doing. But in effect, it's the people that are paying for this and the cholera and the starvation that's going on is atrocious. We should not be supporting this.
Joyce, thanks for the call. Ali, your thoughts on the anecdotes that Joyce shared and her thoughts?
Well, I think she's right on the money. I mean, the number of people, you're talking about millions. Just imagine for a second if these people were Christians, so to speak. Let's just be honest about this. Would there be little attention paid as such right now, or should there, would there be more outrageous or outrage coming from the West? You know, it doesn't matter. You know, in the end, we are humans. And the Yemenis got really themselves back in a very bad situation. And they are very poor. They don't have any external support. They are being blockaded. And even the United Nations cannot do its job. And all we are doing it in the name of Saudi war against the Houthis. I think this is way, way overblown in terms of the power of the Houthis or what have you. In the end, you need some kind of settlements. But let's say, God forbid, there's going to be escalation of war in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is not going to, or if the Saudi Arabia had a conflict with Iran, Saudi Arabia will not fight a war against Iran on its own. They would like, obviously, to drag Iran, United States, into that such a war. So to argue that another $8 billion going to Saudi Arabia is going to make him somehow stronger, that's a ridiculous argument. Saudi Arabia, in about 2017, and they kind of agreed in two different agreements with the United States to purchase $287 billion. $287 billion. Saudi Arabia is flooded with weapons. So it's not just the weapons they need. They need a better policy. They need better foreign policy makers. They need a more responsible government in order to make better policy decisions for them. So again, arms transfer does not going to make Saudi Arabia more secure because they're already flooded with weapons. But instead, what it does is scares Iranians and in the region, who basically says Americans are having their naval ships here, they have bases all over in Bahrain, in Qatar, in Kuwait, and of course in Oman, and they are geared at regime change. Although President Trump says we are not. But nevertheless, the perception from Tehran is that we are being surrounded, in a way, by American troops. And, of course, America also has troops present in Afghanistan and Iraq. So Iranians feel insecure. And that, again, could lead more tension. And God forbid that tension could lead to accidental firing or some kind of a false flag situation. And that could escalate into a war, which would really not serve the U.S. interests, neither would serve Iran interests. But unfortunately, as been repeatedly said, it would serve the interests of Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Bahrain, and United Arab Emirates to a large extent, because these are the major forces promoting the whole notion of a war against Iran. You've heard this so many times at the expense of repeating myself. But people like John Bolton or Mike Pompeo, they are not interested in any diplomatic solution when it comes to Iran. And as such, as long as we have such urgency to start a new war front in Iran, Saudi Arabia would push for that. So the better solution, of course, is, I would get out of John Bolton tomorrow if I were President Donald Trump. You need to have a more sound diplomatic approach. Iranians are under a lot of pressure. The economy is under a lot of pressure. There always can be back channel, and there could be already some at work. But some kind of solution can come out of this. We could de-escalate Yemen. We could pour aid there. And, of course, in the end, diplomacy and international law are the best tools that we have in our disposal to avoid further conflict.
Joyce, thanks for that call. Ali, in our last minute or so, what would you want to see happen in the short run in Yemen to de-escalate and to solve this horrible humanitarian situation?
Well, first of all, we need to have a ceasefire. Some of the rebels have withdrawn from the ports in Yemen, like Port of Hadida. The Saudi forces, they should also pull away. There should be UN peacekeepers troops stationed. Could be the formation of a new government. And from there on, we need to have Saudi money or Arab rich countries in the Persian Gulf money to help with Yemen to recover its from this devastated war. There is no fundamental reason that Iran can be or should be seen as a threat or Saudi Arabia as an enemy. One last thing I want to emphasize that you have to question to what extent Saudi policy represent the will of the Saudi people. I think most Saudi themselves, they feel for what's going on in Yemen. And they are not necessarily in favor of what the government is doing in Yemen. I don't think anybody in sound mind would kind of acknowledge and would be okay with bombing innocent people and pushing them to starvation.
Ali, thanks for joining us today.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
Ali Aboutalibi is a professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. He joins today to talk about the recent announcement that the U.S. will sell Middle Eastern countries, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, weapons to the tune of $8 billion, citing an emergency power that allows them to do that without congressional approval.